Rom. That is my first memory in life. He looked harmless enough, bundled in a blanket and struggling to focus his eyes. My cousin Gary and I were fairly impressed with his grasp reflex. All babies will grab onto a finger as it touches their palm. Since this was his only real trick, he seemed pretty useless. My mother, however, acted like he was extremely precious and treated him with so much care that it was clear that she loved him every bit as much as she loved me. Although I could not form the words or express the feelings they evoked, part of me knew that here was a competitor. In December 1959, Gary was 5 years old, and I was just two. Two skinny kids with the same dark brown hair, brown eyes, and strong chins. We looked like brothers and spent so much time together that we felt like brothers, too. For months, my parents had been trying to prepare me for the arrival of a real sibling. They had given me a doll to play with and encouraged me to take care of her. And when the baby, a little boy they named Rom, finally arrived, they encouraged me to help take care of him, too. On this particular morning, Gary and I were jumping up and down on our convertible sofa. It was a monstrous, ugly piece of furniture covered in indestructible black naugahyde. When opened, it practically filled the living room in our first Chicago apartment, and the metal that held the mattress was so thin and springy that when we used the sofa as a trampoline, we could make the whole frame shake. My mother had made breakfast, dispatched my father to care for patients at Michael Reese Hospital, and fed and diapered the baby. Dodging the toys on the floor, including that doll, which I had beheaded, she brought the baby into the living room and called to us to stop our gymnastics and come look at him. We did as we were told, inspecting the snuffling, wizened little creature with very dark skin, a snubby nose, and a wild spray of black hair. "I'm going to put Rami down here, and you boys can watch him for a little while. Take care of him," said my mother. Clearly she hoped that we might like being the big boys in charge for a few minutes. My guess is that she also needed a little break. We seemed agreeable enough, so she laid Rom down on the sofa bed's mattress and surrounded him with pillows to make him secure before leaving the room. It took us only a few seconds before we decided to climb back up on the bed and invent a new game that might have been called Bounce the Baby. We positioned ourselves on either side of the little bundle and timed our jumps so that we landed simultaneously. The mattress bowed and the metal bands that held it were loaded with enough energy to bounce Rom on the surface of the bed. Instantly, we grasped the situation's potential. With enough effort and perfect timing, we might bounce Rom off the mattress and onto the floor. We couldn't restrain ourselves, and we were too excited to remember to be quiet. The noise we made as we jumped like a couple of jackhammers brought my mother running into the room. "Stop! Stop right now!" It's not so easy to stop bouncing once you get going. As Gary and I crashed together, my mother scooped Rom off the bed with a sweep of her arm. Tall, with long brown hair and a beautiful, warm and open face, my 26-year-old mother was young and strong, but the sight of her second-born son being launched into the air had sent her heart racing. As Gary and I tumbled to a stop, she took a moment to catch her breath and choose her next move. Though we had behaved like idiots, my mother knew we were too young to have formed any malice aforethought. As a devotee of the pediatrician and author Benjamin Spock, who appealed to her with his radically sympathetic approach to child-rearing, she had vowed to control the impulse to scream, hit, or punish us. "Boys," she finally said, "babies aren't grown up enough to play that way. You could have hurt Rami if he fell off the bed, or you fell onto him." She was right, of course, and she tried to correct us without berating us. Few mothers would have exercised the restraint my mother showed that morning, and fewer still would have had such confidence in Spock's advice that they would have followed it so closely and with such conviction in the heat of battle. Later, she bundled us three boys up and bounced the stroller down the stairs so we could walk a few blocks in the stinging cold December air to a local market. Along the way, we passed some of our neighbors, older Jewish women, who clucked in Yiddish, assuming she did not know that they were saying something disparaging about the hillbillies with all their kids. Low rents and easy access to public transportation had made our neighborhood popular with poor whites from Appalachia who flocked to Chicago seeking jobs. Distinctive in the way they talked and dressed, these newcomers had met their share of bigotry, and the term hillbilly was a put-down. My mother, who refused to use the word, startled the women with a little Yiddish admonition, "Ich bin a Yid," which means "I am a Jew," to remind them of the ugliness of prejudice and their own ignorance.